We've been talking primarily on Monday and Tuesday about those in the evangelical born-again movement who see the tremendous changes and conflicts and problems facing the traditional institutions of marriage and family in this country, and I tried to outline some of the positions and some of the solutions that some of well-known people in the movement have made. And Monday was Maribel Morgan and Bill Gothard, and yesterday was Larry Christensen, and then from a different position, a Roman Catholic, more or less naturalist, religious position, was Michael Novak. And today I thought, rather than continue with strictly the evangelical born-again, although that would be interesting, and there are some good books there, and I'll mention those in a minute, we would take up simply the question of what can be called male liberation, or what should be the response of males to these changing forces in our society, in our day, and see what happens with this, but not necessarily looking at it from the standpoint of it being limited to within the born-again movement. For those who weren't here, I've finished a manuscript on this, the born-again evangelical thing, talking about various people, some of whom I mentioned, also Schuller and Anita Bryant and the Christian school movement, which is very strong. And the on Saturday, I will be doing one on religious broadcasting and the religious media. That'll be the 700 Club and the PTL and things like that, which should be good fun. But that isn't really connected with this theme that we're talking about now, about changing roles so far as marriage and family and basic social institutions are concerned with this. And so I won't necessarily refer specifically to the born-again phase part of the movement, although one of the two authors whom I want to use certainly could be considered to be very strongly into that movement, but that really isn't a part of it. The whole question, I think, transcends any specific sort of theological position, such as the evangelical or mainline or Catholic or liberal or whatever sort of label you want to paste onto this sort of thing. And what I'd like to do is briefly give an introduction to what the problem is, what the questions that we're discussing are, define these kinds of things for us very, very briefly, and then briefly give two different viewpoints for the resolutions to these kinds of problems, and then I don't think I have to worry about the discussion with this particular group following from that. It's not a funeral parlor here. I found that's for sure. And the more really the better. There's no necessary goodness in controversy as such, and so on. And yesterday some people still aren't sure where I was playing the devil's advocate and where I wasn't. And all I can say is I'm not sure either with this. So we'll let it go at that. But the idea about what should be the role of men, both as males and as husbands and as fathers, came along later, obviously, than the women's movement. We usually like, in the historical circles, to date the beginning formally of the women's movement with 1963, with the publication of Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique. There has to be a time when a movement starts. You can say it started earlier, and so on. But certainly, by 1963, the Friedan book was the formal beginning of that, because she started raising questions about this, and I'll be reading from a man whose whole life was changed because his wife's life was changed after she had read that book. And I remember vividly, I was at Union Seminary at the time when the book came out, and some of you don't know that in seminaries, it isn't all sober, quiet, pious, reflection, to put it mildly. And at Union, there's a famous elevator where you go up three or four floors, and one day we walked in, and here was about a five-foot cardboard statue of Marilyn Monroe, and somebody had put a big sign on it, The Feminine Mystique. this in Union Theological Seminary, where we were on our way to a class by Reinhold Niebuhr or Paul Tillich or something, and, it offered a nice kind of contrast to this, and because seminaries can get to be places where things can get to be a little heavy and solemn and so on.
That couldn't happen nowadays.
No, it couldn't. It wouldn't. It wouldn't go on. But I remember it with some affection and. And a little bit of surprise, because that was the first full-time seminary experience I had had, and it's a great place to start. Anyway, starting really in the 1970s, if you want to call it a backlash, certainly a response to the women's movement got started among certain authors and certain writers and thinkers in our country, and has spread to now within mainline and evangelical circles themselves. And one symptom of this is the fact that in the bookstores, usually what we like to call Christian bookstores, you can find three or four titles which deal directly with this. The Christian Man, Tim LaHaye, who has a book on almost any, he's about as trendy as Martin Marty, has a book out on this. One I like is Fred Renish, which is really a very good book on this, and the one I'm going to be using from is William Malcolmson's Success is a Failure Experiment, Male Liberation and the American Myth of Success, which is, he's a seminary professor in American Baptist Seminary of the West, and so on. And there are many kinds of, many different approaches to this, but I think what's happening is that out of defensiveness, backlash, whatever you want to call it, that the male population is trying to absorb and understand what women have been trying to say formally, and certainly long before the Friedan book came out, but formally since Ellis came out, and since the ERA has come out, and the various caucuses and pressure groups and activities connected with that have emerged in our society. The movement is sort of a late one, but nevertheless, I think some of the early forms of the male movement within the churches, and that's what I want to be talking about, are taking form. There is also a very clear male liberation movement outside the churches, a purely humanistic or secular one, and the best book there some of you, when I say the name, will think of the old guy who drew crazy inventions, and that's Rube Goldberg. But it's Dr. Reuben Goldberg's The Hazards of Being Male. There are a lot of cheap, flashy, sensationalist kinds of things. Michael Kort has got a book out, which I don't think much of, but that one's really quite good, from a secular standpoint. But the beginnings of a male response to what's taking place, I think, is evident. And I'm either courageous enough or foolish enough to plunge in and see what happens with this. All right, now we've been discussing the challenges that many Americans, church people in our case especially, have seen to the stability of the institutions of family and marriage, parenthood, in our society. And that we have seen how threatened many people feel, and the movement towards reestablishing order, stability, traditional answers to these, how popular this has become in certain, in certain circles. And where perhaps the male movement is the most vulnerable, or where the controversy, I think, is the most vigorous right at the time, is in the question of what a male liberation movement would mean in terms of another very cherished American value, and that's the value of success in America, because America has always been an achieving society. Some of you know I was in Asia the first semester, and the contrast there, where people just don't care about achievement, they just care about a bowl of rice and a little shade from the sun, which is, I suppose, that's what we get here too. At least the latter is really all that, about 95% of the people care about. They simply were not into achievement. They were not into success. It could be due to the, to the diet. It could be due to the weather. It could be due to a large number of things. Buddhism is a passive religion, not a pacifist religion. It's a passive religion. I think that has a great deal to do with this. But coming back to America suddenly again, we saw, I saw very clearly, the pressures, the demands for achievement, the achievement syndrome, if you want to call it, or the success of achievement in America, as a way, you see, not only of bringing home the bacon, so to speak, not only of providing, but of proving yourself, of being a success out in the world, as a test, you see, of your maleness, of your very personhood as a male. This is being challenged because what is coming from, from other liberation movements is the dangers, the traps really, and the pitfalls that emerge when the success or the achievement syndrome becomes so dominant that it really sort of overshadows and dominates really the fact that those who are caught up in the success or the achievement syndrome are human beings also, and that they've lost their humaneness in the name of achievement and success. And this has become really, in a sense, polarized, you see, in the debate that's starting now, because the stereotypes, you see, are that women are supposed to be the sympathizers, the sensitive ones, the maternal ones. Men are supposed to be strong. The men are supposed to be, you know, aggressive. Men are supposed to be self-controlled, disciplined. The ones who can go out there into the jungle, you know, of the business world, so to speak, and keep their cool, and come home and be in full control of themselves all the time, and it's very embarrassing, you know, to really show emotion. And I know myself, very frankly, the first time I came to Holden, to hug another male was a real blast, a trauma for me, because I just, you know, wasn't used to it. I don't think my father did anything more than give me a kick in the pants by way of touching me, you know, as long as I lived. And really, you know, every so often just let fly. It's a very difficult thing. And our popular culture, which I've drawn on before, reemphasizes this. Just to give you a couple of examples, in television advertising, John was talking Sunday, if any of you are here, John Schramm was talking about a wonderful ad about Mustang 2, boredom zero. That was the thing. And then he was talking about all the trouble that they had with, they didn't have any boredom with their Mustang. But anyway, just give you a couple of examples of this. You remember the one Kelly's Tires? Is a very good one like this. You've got all these men in t-shirts and in strong male colors in green and brown, and about 40 men for some reason come marching through town carrying tires. We're good and tough, you know, and so on. But it's all males who are doing these this sort of thing. And then of course what happens in one of them, they've got two or three, that some, you know, dizzy-minded, you know, stereotyped woman sort of comes tripping after them. I don't know why she is, but I guess they have to get the contrast. She's so attracted to all this machismo that she can't stay away or something. I don't know what it is. But it's the idea that if you're, you know, you're good and tough, and it's all males, you see, who are good and tough, as the example for this. Or you watch the ad for Miller's Beer. Would be a good one. It's always men who are pipe fitters up in Alaska, or they are hauling, they're lifting loads at the dock in New York City or wherever it is. And the women in it are portrayed as waitresses, but it's the men who are there all the way through. I like the best answer to that one was one I heard Ellen Goodman. Some of you know her column. She writes twice a week on the American Family, and she wrote the one about what happens, what's wrong with the ring around the collar ad. Women's whole day is wiped out if she finds a ring around the collar. She's not doing her job. She's not being a good, you know, she's not clean, really, and she, you know, looks pale and all the rest of these things. And Goodman's response was, what's wrong with that is, why not, you know, teach the male to wash his neck, you know. Really, and if you see, it's the woman's fault that the collar, you know, that the collar's dirty. That's the point, because males are out there and males sweat, and sweat is good because it's hard and tough, and you know all the things that go along with this sort of thing. You know, you could go on with this sort of thing indefinitely. And what's interesting, just by way of further, one more point with the introduction, is that the psychological research we have to date on this shows that this idea of success through competition is simply, a socially induced sort of value rather than sort of natural or instinctive to men. With this, that the men, for instance, in really high positions of success or, you know, great achievement are there not because they've enjoyed the competition, not because they've plunged in, you know, that ad for Safeguard soap, that it's a jungle out there, Alice, and I have to have my Safeguard, you know, before I go out and so on and else. But they're successful not because they're competitive, not because they enjoy the struggle that way, but because they enjoy doing their job well and because they simply enjoy, you know, work for its own sake. And that's the reward which they get, and it's not from being competitive. But in America, with the free market economy and, you know, other forces that you can talk about here, the emphasis is put on proving yourself, you see, through competition, through achievement. If it's bigger, it's better. Everything in America has to be new and improved. Viva towels, isn't that the one that they're, you know, you always wonder, why did they put out such a shabby product before? If it's improved now, why didn't they have it improved 5 years ago? And so on. You could multiply that out into cars and so on. But I think you see what I'm trying to get at in this kind of introduction, that the competitive, strong, self-controlled male thing is culturally induced rather than natural and instinctive. And some people, males, are beginning to, you know, raise questions about this, whether or not, you know, this is really the case, whether or not this is simply an American value, and that's why I use the comparison to Thailand, rather than something which is instinctual, because, you know, we heard yesterday about the fact that, you know, in divine order, that some are stronger than others, and so on. All right, now. I want to, with that introduction, I want to go into just very briefly two descriptions of the role of the male today, as seen by two people who I think are good representatives of the two schools. And I choose one here very deliberately because he's evangelical in the born-again sense. He's well-known, famous, the very, very serious and devout churchman, and has written a great deal. This is the son of the original Richard Leigh Turneau. And some of you know Leigh Turneau was the man who invented and developed the earth mover equipment, these big yellow skinners and cats and all the rest of this sort of thing that come and, you know, take over the environment and so on. Well, Leigh Turneau became a multimillionaire and became the epitome, really, of the success story in America, because he started from nothing. Just like Andrew Carnegie starting at $1.20 a day, and, you know, Henry Ford starting nowhere, and you know, so many of the other success stories, and built himself up. The one I'm most familiar with would be William Danforth, who started off from $25 in 1920 or something, and built up Ralston Purina into an enormously successful and very generous philanthropic organization. If any of you are from St. Louis, of course, you would know, you know, Checkerboard Square and that sort of thing. But Leigh Turneau has a book here called Success Without Compromise, which I think is Regal Press or SP Publications, from where else? Wheaton, Illinois, as I've called it before. That's the Rome of the evangelicals. But Victor Books, right. I want to very briefly analyze this. And this is not, you know, 1890 stuff when you had Andrew Carnegie writing that, you know, it you should allow people to be rich so they could have enough money to give away to the poor. And so on, but this is 1977, and one which I want to use as my example, and a very conscientious churchman. Some of you know there's Leigh Turneau College. The father turned around tithing. He gave 90% away rather than 10%. Well, you can say cynically, of course, he had so much he could give away 90%, but he didn't have to. That was the point, and lived a very simple lifestyle, and wasn't ostentatious, and, you know, didn't join the jet set, and all the things that are associated with this. All right. Now, his basic argument is the classic case, you see, for proving oneself, you know, in the world of business, that what pays off, is the sort of the definition of success in America, are the traditional virtues, which I want to list here, and then sort of elaborate a little bit on this. Hard work, self-control, authority — he's very clear on how to establish and maintain authority — drive, self-denial, logic, persistence. Hard work pays off. Everybody has an equal opportunity in life. We all start at the same starting line, and if you get where you to a certain point, that's where, you know, you're supposed to get in this world. That there is a natural sort of falling out in this world where the most gifted and talented people are the ones who achieve the most, and everybody sort of eventually finds their station or their niche in life, and that's, you know, sort of built into the system all the way through. And argues that when this takes place, real significant progress takes place in the American economy, because The American economy is based on growth, on change, on improvement, raising the standard of living, you know, utilizing new technology. Therefore, he argues, you see, and this is very much like the traditional Puritan work ethic, that what we are to do in the old teachings of the doctrine of stewardship is to turn two talents into four, five into ten, instead of, you know, the one who got one talent and buried it. All right. What does that mean? If you're in the business, let me turn that around. If you're a farmer, you be the very best farmer you can be. Or if you're a doctor or a fisherman or whatever, you know, whatever the occupation is, you're to do your very best. Turn two talents into four, five into ten. A workman is worthy of his hire. You know, you can multiply the proof text on this sort of thing. All right. And that you bring your best to God. That's the idea. You do this as a response to the bounty this developed in America, because they found all this rich land with the minerals and the good climate and all the rest, and they had to find a reason as to why God should, you know, have brought them here and given them all this fantastic kind of opportunity. And the explanation for this was the what we call the doctrine of providence, was that God had a reason for this, and that was that they should dominate the earth, and they should replenish and not only replenish but control and improve the standard of living. And therefore, what I'm trying to say here, you see, is that in the world of business, the measurement of success in business, you see, is maximization of profit. And maximization of profit then, you see, becomes the way in which you know you're doing God's will. Because if you're a businessman and you turn two talents into four, five into ten, you're obviously following this particular doctrine of stewardship, and therefore what you strive to do is to, you know, acquire wealth or maximize profit profit with this. And therefore, you see, what I would call a secular standard came to dominate the Puritan ethic, because the original New England Puritans who came there felt they simply did their best and they brought it before God and laid it on the altar, and that was it. And God took it from there. And they didn't really worry what the world thought, because they had pleased God as best they could in mastering the new world, what they like to call the howling wilderness. And if you've been in a Massachusetts winter with a nor'easter coming in, you know exactly what that is, and survival. And therefore, they felt that they were, you know, still under the discipline, so to speak, of God's mandate so far as stewardship was concerned. But later on, especially in the 18th century, this idea got secularized, that we were always to do our best to succeed, and those who succeeded in this world, in other words, those who maximized wealth were the ones who deserved this, because they had the talents and the resources to do so, and therefore they should be rewarded for this. God helps those, you know, who help themselves, sort of thing, with this, and therefore the secular standard for success was accepted by large numbers of people, and it's still accepted, you know, and I respect the position by Richard Turnell, with this, because since this is happening, how could it be otherwise than God's will that all this should be taking place, creating new jobs, new opportunities, new ways of raising the standard of living, and so on. But it's done, you see, through an emphasis on the traditional male values of self-denial, control, hard work, thrift, drive, and above all, the reward through, you know, what we call the achievement syndrome. And therefore, these are the values, and the values that are to be rewarded and encouraged and to be inculcated, you see, in youth with it, especially the idea of self-control, the idea of discipline, of bringing home a briefcase, you know, of work at night, because that's what's demanded with this. And even, you know, right up to the present, this idea, I think, is still very strong in many, many circles. All right. But as I suggested, there has been a slow, but I think a growing backlash against this, and I'd like to talk briefly about the third part of this, or the reaction to this, in another book by a seminary professor, William Malcolmson, and I'll be glad to share this with anybody afterwards. This came out in 1976 with Abingdon. Success is a failure experiment, male liberation and the American myth of success. And a man who, I'll just read it here, a professor of ministry and director of field and continuing education for the American Baptist Seminary of the West. And they live in Oakland, California. Okay. It's a different kind of argument altogether. And what Malcolmson argues here is that males need liberation as much as women. Obviously, of a much different sort. They don't need the kind of liberation that you find in the battle with the legal system. For instance, over credit cards or whatever else. I'll give you a personal example here. It is a small, but you know, we'd like to feel kind of a nice little triumph. Helen took out an insurance policy and paid all the premiums herself, arranged it all for herself, and was Northwestern Mutual, a good company, big company, not any little fly-by-night company, and in order to get the policy in operation, I had to sign it. And I was abroad, and they even sent the papers over there. And I didn't know what to do, and so I signed it, and she wasn't willing to let go along with that. And so Northwestern Mutual's objection was that, well, the male is the chief breadwinner. And therefore, since that is the case, he has to sign before any financial arrangement, which involves the whole family is concerned, is under question here. And what had happened just at the time that we got this letter from Northwestern Mutual was that we got our W-2s. And as whatever fate or providence or whatever else would have it, Helen made more than I did last year. And so who's the chief breadwinner in the family with this? And Northwestern Mutual did back down. And, and I don't know if it's a general change in policy, but, we made the point with this. It was her money, and she should have, you know, control over it. So that's what I mean by the fact that males don't have this kind of liberation problem, and with credit cards, and this is a whole field, you know, women's legal rights and everything that's going on. But that's a small but kind of personal example. Same thing is true in politics, you know, ERA and so on. But male liberation, he argues, is necessary emotionally and internally. With this, what Malcolmson is arguing here is a hard look at the fact that the pressure, I should say, that the male measures himself as being, you know, successful, as being an achiever, bringing home as much as possible to spread around to the family, and being measured, you see, in terms of affection on the basis of what he brings home to the family rather than how they regard them themselves. Martin Marty tells a wonderful story about this. He was driving around, he was in a taxi cab about 2 weeks before Christmas in Chicago, and they got talking with a cabbie, and the cabbie said he was only driving part-time to make, you know, some extra money for Christmas. And he was spending all his nights. He had another job in the daytime, but he was spending all night driving the cab. And Marty asked him what for, and he said, well, he wanted to buy a stereo set for his family. And he had been at it for about 8 weeks, and he still had about two more weeks to go. And he took himself away from the family, you know, long enough at night so that he could buy the stereo for them. And Marty said, well, maybe they would rather have you home than have a stereo set. And the cabbie, you know, said he hadn't thought of that. But it makes the point, I think, rather nicely here. In other words, what Malcolmson is arguing here is for a reevaluation of evaluating oneself, you see, on the basis of the standards of the world, or on the success syndrome that I've talked about before with this. And the problem, you see, is a very real one, because there are so many things that a very large salary can do that really can improve the family and can do things for the for everybody can involved. I mean, college is expensive. I just shudder to think, for instance, when I see what it is at our school for next year, and I don't think any of us would feel that if our children are qualified in that particular direction, that they should be, you know, denied college opportunity. Europeans marvel at the way in which American parents sacrifice for their children, hock themselves, you know, for years and years to come. Or, you know, the necessity for insurance, I think is obvious, but insurance is policy. Insurance policies are expensive. Or, you know, travel is great, but travel costs, you know, for the family, but travel costs costs a lot of money. What I'm trying to say is that many good and worthwhile things in the world which would benefit the family, in this particular case, are expensive. And therefore, many feel that the best way in which these good things for the family can be achieved is through, you know, being out in that world and working as hard and maximizing as much, you know, profit as possible. So they get caught up in the trap, and they don't dare fail, you know, in any degree. They don't dare let down, because if they let down and if they don't work as hard as possible and move up, you know, as much as possible, then in some real way they consider themselves a failure to the family, even though the family itself might not believe this sort of thing. And a very good example of this, and it's probably happened, you know, for some people here in the room, is when a family gets stabilized in a community and is suddenly transferred. And all the wrenching and the pain and all the rest, you're transferred because there's more money, there's more power, there's more authority, you know, there's more status and all the rest. But what that does to a family, of course, is you know, can be very traumatic with this sort of thing. But what Malcolmson is saying here, you see, is that few males today dare break through this kind of mold, through the success achievement mold, to get out from under with this and find, you know, alternative kinds of careers that might be possible, that lead away from the idea that you're measured primarily, you see, in terms of how the world looks at you in that way. All right. And I think probably the best thing I can do is read something, a couple of selections from here, and then we can see what happens so far as the discussion is concerned. This might pinpoint it a little bit for you. All right. When I am with women who are into the women's movement, and I sit with them through a lecture by a man who speaks of man or men, oops, I turned over too many pages. Where is, did I get, 89, that's right, I've got, I want to go on 93 too, but I want to get on 89 first. Okay. When I speak with a man who speaks of, quote, men or man, when he means both sexes, I sit there and agonize. Partly because I am afraid that one of my women friends is going to stand up and make a speech about sexist language, and I hate confrontation. And partly because I feel personally that the women are being put down and they are persons like me, and I resent being put down. Is it so difficult to say he and she, or is it to say persons instead of men? It is a lot easier the more you do it. It is freeing to think of yourself primarily as a person and secondarily as male. You feel a lot closer to a much wider variety of people, particularly to people who are gay or bisexual, but also to people who are heterosexual or feeling-oriented if males, or aggressive if females. You don't have to put up with this nonsense about men not crying or hugging other men. And you don't have to feel defensive about aggressive women. We are all persons, and some persons cry. Some hug, some dominate, some do a lot of things that are very human, much more than they are male or female. I think this is what St. Paul meant by, quote, neither male nor female. He didn't mean that there weren't men and women. He meant that there wasn't, he meant that that wasn't the main thing. The main thing is that we are persons, and that God can love us, and that we can care for, with, and about each other. You could berate Jesus for not being married or not engaging in sexual intercourse, as D.H. Lawrence did, but I am rather glad that he chose not to be like most men. He wasn't gay, but he was single. He didn't push celibacy, but as far as we know, he didn't have intercourse. He was a person who lived his lifestyle, and that was the thing, his thing to do at that time. He was first of all a person and secondarily a man. All this business about painting Jesus so he looks more masculine, or selecting the scripture passages which bring out his machismo, is rather ridiculous. He was who he was, and let's not make him into someone who compensates for our lacks or fits into our images. If I am a person and you are a person, then we aren't only brothers or sisters. We are human beings. Hello, person. Hello, human being. The friends knew what they were doing. He means the Quakers there who used that particular phrase. They used to call each other by their full names. If I were greeted by a friend or Quaker, I would be greeted as William Lacey Malcolmson, middle name and all, not just as Brother Bill, but with no title, no modifier. Just me. It takes a couple more syllables, but it's worth it. And then one more here that I thought was especially useful. To sort of sum up what I've been trying to say here, because the American myth that success is the norm is pure fantasy or impure farce. Failure, not success, is the norm. And this is all right. It isn't wrong. It is all right. The majority of people do not make a success of their lives. Most of them, to paraphrase the words of T.S. Eliot, measure out their lives with coffee spoons. Most people are sad or in neutral more than they are happy. We simply do not live as the TV situation comedies say we should live. They are a lie. We do not live as characters and lived in the syrupy movies of the 40s and 50s. They were a lie, too. One summer when I was in college, I was an elevator operator on the Upper West Side of New York City. On a particular day, a fellow operator and I were talking about our jobs. I hated mine. He had no love for his either. He said, "Well, most people don't like their jobs, right?" I was young and I thought, he has to be wrong. I don't think he was now. I think he was dead right. There are a few of us privileged types who have a lot of education, the right parents and a good many breaks along the way, who happen to be in jobs we enjoy. But we are in the minority. Jesus won't bring you success. You can walk down every sawdust trail in the nation, get converted over and over again, sing praise God every 5 minutes, and you can still fail miserably. Any evangelist who tells you that this Jesus brings success is a charlatan. Sure, Jesus can help you overcome drugs. He can help you overcome your drinking problem, can help your marriage. But once you have dealt with these problems, your whole life is right out there in front of you, full of other kinds of failures. I had a friend who was in prison for 9 years of his life. He lived for the moment when he could be released. He had made it. Success, freedom. Then he got into drugs, smashed up his car, and has been in and out of jail again. He's out of prison now, to be sure. He probably will not go in again. He has a fine wife, but he will never achieve the American dream of success. He will be a failure who adjusts to his failing over and over again. Jesus can help you over spectacular hurdles and forgive for you for colossal sins, but most of what Jesus really does is to help you make it through the average, normal day of mostly failure, some success. It isn't a bad religion, really, on the whole. And there's one more passage here, but I think that sums up what I would like to say is the main thrust of the beginning for this. All right. Would you agree with the diagnosis that many American males, if not most, to start the discussion, are caught up in the success syndrome? Is that a fair assumption to start with? And then the question be, okay?
Even if they don't
want to
be.
Personally or for the family? Personally or what?
Or for the family.
If you have a family, you can't evade the responsibilities that a family brings. So you probably get your reward, so to speak, by considering yourself to be, like a taxi driver, a good provider for the family. He provided them with a stereo, but he didn't provide them with, 8 weeks of being at home with them every night. So I don't think you can necessarily separate the two out. That's what I'm trying to say.
I think the liberation question, in part, is a redefinition of success. And I think a second example, a very sad man. Sort of tragic outlook. Then the best you have to hope for is mediocrity, vanilla.
Manila?
Vanilla.
Oh, vanilla.
No flavor. I'm not so sure I would agree with your assumption that the average male is caught up in success syndrome. When I think of my associates and people I know, I'm not quite sure how you distinguish, but every male that I know probably works reasonably hard and has for a reward. But I'm not sure that that most of them are overachievers. I think many, many people that I know have settled in at a level. Probably they could, if they worked hard, advance beyond that level, but they're satisfied with the level that they're at. And I'm not, I don't know that I buy that the average American male is caught up in the success
system. Would they turn down a promotion?
Yes, in some cases, but I think maybe more importantly, the question is, Are they willing to strive exceedingly hard to get the promotion? And a lot of them are not.
I think a lot of them get pushed into it.
I think my point is that yes, they work in order to earn a living, in order to provide for the family. But I don't think that the idea of trying to reach the top is foremost in most of their minds.
There can only be a few at the top, but I mean, within the shop or within the office or within the department, whatever it might be, I think there is the game going on, the power struggle going on, and the office politics going on all the time.
It depends on what kind of city you're in. I'm sure you can point to situations where that's true, but I'm equally sure that I could point to many situations where that's not true.
That, well, over here.
I think you do.
Okay.
In dealing with that, how much of this is a result, because you sort of implied that it was a unique American experience.
Well, I would say of an industrial society.
Okay, well, how much of this is the result, because the only criteria for American success is sort of a monetary thing, with the breakdown of the corporate family? In other words, would this be true 60 years ago in a more beyond the nuclear family? I mean, right now, any of us are pretty much dependent upon ourselves, and our brothers and sisters and fathers are not going to financially carry us along, or we're not financially involved intricately with them. And therefore, the success becomes more paramount in that way. In other words, if you're in an organization where people are not, where there's a stronger bond between them, maybe the success motive, you know, is not as strong. There's more of a feeling, well, we're not going to dog-eat-dog so much. Or am I making that clear?
Yeah. I just don't know if that's the case. You know, we're dealing in generalization.
Because I think there's a greater breakdown of the extended family in America than in even other industrial countries.
But to come back to what I'm saying is that when the more intense the nuclear family becomes, and the more dependent they become on the breadwinner, the more pressure there is to achieve. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and because I guess I was reacting very strongly inside to your first opening comment about Asians.
I don't say that critically at all. If I had a chance, I'd go back to Thailand tomorrow, because I like being on Thai time, for instance, which is a delightful thing. And they simply have not been exposed to the world of the rat race or this.
But there's a need for success, but it's expressed in a, what I'm saying is, it's not expressed in a nuclear sense. It's expressed in a corporate sense, and therefore, if you're working for an organization, it has more of a corporate thing, and this is where the corporate body of Christianity could fit in also, then you are not necessarily sustained by an individual success motivation.
But is that really the case? Isn't it what I'm suggesting in our society, that we still measure ourselves against other people and what they've achieved?
I think it depends on the organization you're working with, though, too, and the attitude of your coworkers. That's what I mean.
Maybe the young executives are changing. They're not looking for to go, you know, work all the time. They're looking for more of the good life, leisure and have time with their family. I see that in some of the younger couples that are still married. They're not looking for, you know, that kind of life. Spend all their time finding success.
You're more to the depression.
It seems to me that it's also a personality difference. There are some people who just say, you know, the difference, well, we've made this decision in one area, is that the difference in pay is not worth the difference in hassle. So we're not going to seek the next step on the ladder because it's just not worth it. It means being on call, it means, you know, so many other things that will disrupt what we want out of life that we're just not going to work for.
For about $500 a year or more.
Yeah, you know, it's not worth it, so we're going to stay where we're at.
Go ahead. You're warning.
I can make one comment. The fact that the wives are working too at the same time, and that helps the family situation, and maybe they don't have to. The breadwinner, male, doesn't have to really concern himself with going up that fast. But I think no matter in our situation today in our economy and the way we have inflation, that he can't afford, and he's not going to, and he doesn't stay where he is. He's going to, he is forced, whether he likes it or not, to, in some measure, continue to try to go higher than he is now. If no other, for no other reason, is just to stay equal, you know, to stay level. We all were getting hung up a little bit on the definition of success, and of course that's a real personal thing,
yeah.
What it is to me or what it is to you.
But I would use success in the sense of achievement and proving yourself as a person through your success in your, you know, in your occupation. And that requires what we used to like to call, you know, masculine virtues of self-control, discipline, aggressiveness, you know, and that sort of thing, which puts a mask over the fact that, you know, males are human too. But how often, for instance, do males have serious, what we would simply call sharing sessions? How difficult it is for males to really sit down and talk openly with one another, or cry in front of each other. That's maybe we can move it in that direction. I don't see it at all, and it's not just, you know, Nordic stoicism. You know, that's too easy, and it's a kind of a racist explanation anyway that goes along with it. Yeah.
Well, my husband's involved in the academic situation. He has a built-in pressure. You have tenure, public appearance, kind of thing. And the pressures are tremendous.
Mm-hmm.
Seems like I've spent my married life fighting against that system, you know, just to have a quality family time. But a role of a Christian in that area, and we're involved in the University of California system, and we're beginning to find some Christian men in that system who can take a time, a very small time, but it's a quality time where they can get together and share the pressures that are on them, and we see men dropping dead, you know, 50. We lost 3 in our department this year. They were here today, and tonight they're dead. And so I think there's a tremendous advantage for the Christian man to seek out other men who are willing to get together and spend a lunchtime or pre-work time and talk to each other and see where you are, see what your pressures are, and share. It's beautiful time.
Why isn't it happening more?
Why? It is. There's no question about it. It's happening from, you know, as compared to 20 years ago or even 10 years ago, at least where we come from. You back that up, Jack. It's sweeping our area. We're not only from a Christian standpoint, but from other standpoints for men and women. Are doing what we're talking about. But one point there that the guy brought up, that one of your authors brought up about failure. You know, I think he's right. I don't think, and of course you have to define failure, but I think you cannot be successful, I'll throw this out, you can't really understand success until you've had failure.
Yeah.
I think his statement may be correct in reality. It may be, in reality, correct, but should that be a goal?
What, that?
Failure.
I'm not saying it should be a goal.
Oh, but what I hear from that reading.
Yeah.
That there's something to be glorified in being a failure.
It may
well be the case that most people fail, and maybe most people fail a majority of the time, but should we set that as a goal?
No, but handling failures is that I think Rich Cameron talked
last night.
It was beautiful. Mm-hmm. To be a good artist, you don't have to learn to be a failure. You have to learn to handle the failures that come along. And I think that's the thing that's not taught, or maybe can't be taught. But you know, going through this life, what needs to be sensitively looked at is the ability to handle failures that come along.
Yeah, and I would add that, Doris, the success achievement, you see, teaches us that when failure comes along, it's our own fault. It's a personal failure. In America, you know, some of you heard me say, it's a sin to be poor. I mean, it's a sin. You know, I only have to throw out welfare people for you. And that raises all kinds of red flags. Welfare people are lazy and cheats, you know, and all the things. Have I told you that I was in Alexandria, buying in Minnesota, buying some post office stamps in at the post office, obviously. And when I got to the window, I gave some money and said how much. And I'd forgotten that the price of stamps had gone up. We had been out at a camp and went away from civilization for a while. And so on. And I just said to nobody in particular, boy, prices just keep going up and up, don't they? And some person said to me in a very loud voice, yeah, it's all these damn people on welfare. You know, and that settled it right then and there for her. Because, you see, it's a sin to be poor in this country, and when failure comes along, it's your own fault. And we laugh at, you know, the poor Southerner, for instance, or the Okies, or, you know, as you find in literature, in Erskine Caldwell or John Steinbeck or whatever it is. And they deserve to be poor. And when the welfare mothers, for instance, in St. Paul asked for, you know, a few extra things, the wrath of God, you know, descended, marches and everything else. There hadn't been so much excitement over any issue, you know, for years, and raising, you know, payments to welfare people.
Well, I think it's how you define success and failure. I think anybody who is really enjoying what he's doing is a success. You are successful when you enjoy. I know. We left the oil business 20 years ago, where my husband was vice president of the major oil company, went into academic work, certainly with a tremendous loss of money, but he never felt like he was a failure. I felt as though he was more of a success after he got into academic work than when he was in commercial work and flying all over the country.
Yeah, and that's what the research shows, that it isn't the competitiveness that sorts out the good from the bad, so far as the achievers are concerned, but it's the people who enjoy their work, you know, more than anything else, and who enjoy hard work and enjoy doing their job well in this country.
We still have to have competitiveness somewhere. In the society, in our structure, in our economy, you can't get away from the fact that you need competitiveness.
But then I would say there is competitiveness in office politics and in the union shop and so on.
May I ask a question? How many here are employers, and how many employers feel that their employees are overachievers? I hire a lot of young professional people, and I don't see them working 6.5 days a week to beat their way up the ladder.
But they take their image of themselves as male on the basis of what they provide, what they're able to provide for their families. See, that's what I'm trying to say.
I think it gets back to the old economic marginal utility of the dollar. How much time are you willing to put in, how much effort are you willing to put in to achieve that additional dollar? And that's different people answer that question differently.
Yeah.
But I think that maybe we're overgeneralizing when we say that the average American male is willing to put in substantially more time and substantially more money, more effort, in order to...
No, I didn't mean to mislead you all. What I was trying to say is that he measures himself in terms of his monetary worth. And rather than being a successful family man or whatever else is like this, because we do sort out people and put them into different slots and give them different titles. And in that particular sense, I think that's the form of, if you want to call it, bondage. And this is what I would understand the liberation movement to be, is to break out from this sort of thing. Break out from the sorting out that the competition, you know, does puts on us, because the pressure to achieve is so enormous.
Of course, for somebody, that would say that now maybe the trend is starting to reverse, and that it is not the thing to be successful. It is not the thing to be have material wealth, and in fact, you know. Take it one step further, that's a sin to have that, you know, and it may end up being that it's more of a sin to have that than it is to be on on corporate welfare.
But what I see happening now in the last 2 or 3 years is college kids are back in the old rat race of achievement again. Mm-hmm. As a contrast to the late 60s and the early 70s, that grade point average determines everything. He's a 3.8, you know, that's it. And that, if you're a 3.8, 3.8, which is about A minus, that pegs you. And drive, and, you know, kids eat dinner at 4.30 so they can get over to the stacks by 5 and get in a really big night at the books. They don't go to the, you know, the football games. They want expensive stereos. They want graduate school so that they don't have to settle for, you know, for blue-collar work. And what? The system. Yeah, the system is what put them there. And you don't find the, you know, we've got a whole group in Northfield. It's a college town. We've got a whole group who are what we call womb babies. I'm sure this is true around the Bay Area, too, or any college town. They can't leave the womb. This is true in Madison, you know, in Minneapolis and so on. And they can't leave, believe it or not, they can't even leave Northfield. And but they are in their late 20s, and they are, you know, conditioned by the anti-achievement, you know, trends of that particular time. And they're self-employed people, they're craftsmen and artisans and so on, and trying to struggle this way. But the new generation is back to the competition thing again. Yes.
For me, that generation, because I'm right at the very tail end, right, of the 60s, folks, is that we had Vietnam, is that we had the peace movement, and now, since I'm down in Berkeley, people always go, oh, radical Berkeley. Well, the last 2 years, the university has sold more season football tickets and has had more people at fraternity and sorority rush than ever before. And to me, that, you know, that's the pendulum swinging back the other way. And it's difficult because the kids that I see at home in the summertime that are just in junior high and high school, their priorities are totally different than what mine are.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're not even close. I think that's a very shallow way to approach a person. He's a 3.8.
Yeah, that's the point I was trying to make. I wasn't
pretty superficial.
Yeah. But I mean, that's what's happening. I'm not saying I agree with it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what's happening with it, because they measure people, you see, by what they achieve, rather than that she's a really fine human, you know, being, or sensitive, or whatever, you know, the case might be with this. And, you know, how do you get out? Yeah. Were you going to say something? Oh. Okay. Yeah, Lois?
What happens if the 3.8 wants to go to med school, and all med schools in the country turn them down? And that happens.
Yes.
White male.
Yeah.
You know? What do they do to keep training the men without? Mm-hmm. Okay. And that guy's got a problem. And the men who feel they're equally qualified as women, or maybe slightly more qualified than women, and women are getting the jobs.
Is that wrong?
Now we're into affirmative action, folks. Just so you know.
I'm not saying that at all. That's a whole other issue. What I was getting at is, what happens to this person?
Yeah.
Who has really ground himself into the ground for 4 years, and then gets the no.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that goes, what is, when you say achieving success in life, I mean, how many of the men in this room feel that they are a success? And is it, if you have a self-image of success, it's not necessarily equated in financial terms.
But it's so difficult to do that when all the pressures tell you you're a success on the basis of what you achieve. That's what I'm trying to say.
Well, then ask how many men in this room think they're a success.
I had the same question in my mind.
I do.
I make a lot of money, and I don't feel successful. And, I don't think, for me, success necessarily has a dollar sign at the top of it.
But a lot of people would
but I don't know. I don't know what should be at the top of this. That's my dilemma.
Yeah, but a lot of people would, you know, if you make a lot of money, a lot of people would change jobs with you, you know, right away.
Yeah, but that wouldn't affect my feeling of myself. I think that's what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily how we're regarded, but how we regard ourselves.
Yeah. Since I don't know you personally, I can ask you then, why don't you take another position so you don't make so much money, so you'll feel better about yourself?
Because I'm chicken.
A family can say, we're happy with where we're at, and we're not going to go through the hassle to go to the next step up the line, you know, whether it's the male moving up or the female moving up or both of them. And, you know, that, and you can be pretty comfortable with where you're at. But then the world looks at you, you know, and says, and we went through a situation where my husband was not able to work for 2.5 years because of an injury, and I was working full time. And people, even people who knew us well and knew why he wasn't working, said, you know, what's with him? He's staying home and doing the housework, and she's out doing the job. There must be something wrong with him. And I mean, this wasn't just the business community. We heard it at our church. We heard it in social gatherings. We heard it a lot of places. And, you know, we fought for a long time to say, hey, you know, we've got a problem. We're dealing with it. And, you know, when he went back to work, then everybody said, oh, gee, you know, aren't you a great guy? You're back to work. Well, he didn't change, and I didn't change, and the kids didn't change, and the world didn't change. But we were suddenly socially acceptable again because he was working.
What I'm pleading for is the way to define yourself and respect yourself apart from your achievement in the business world, and how difficult that is. That's you know, it took me 50 minutes to get there, but that's what I'm trying to say, and how very hard that is for males, especially in this society, because we can't, for all practical purposes, we can't drop out and go back again.
We're prisoners.
Yeah, you know, yeah, very real.
Thinking back, when I felt most successful was after a year of trying my own business that failed, and finally was able, forced into giving up lots of things, you know, a house and our cars and even our bicycle, and we finally ended up selling Kristen's engagement ring. But the point was, each time this layer was peeled off, it was sort of a relief not to have to worry about protecting that thing.
Yeah.
Somebody said that to the victor belongs the spoils. I don't think that's true. I think it's the other way around. At least for me, I became owned by my possessions. I couldn't leave town without having to make sure that everything was great. I couldn't be way too long.
Yeah, yeah.
But the thing that's frightening for me is that now that we're back in that same place where we were before, with a steady income and a house and cars and all that sort of business, I don't have the same self satisfaction feeling about where I am, but I'm not willing to risk going broke again.
Our people are saying that back to this part, crying is a human emotion. It's sort of the backlash of some of these other things that they've been putting down the women who've been supposedly radicals and trying to go for equal rights. But I think that men, you know, if you look at some of these, you'll see that men are making some gains. You're riding on our skirts.
I think I better be pretty good.
Anything wrong with a woman doing anything she wants to do as long as she does it in the home.
I'm leaving.
Right now.
We ended with a gong show, so okay.